Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of the Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a Curiosity Lecture recorded live at the 2017 Festival.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks very much. Shark Week. On your rags. Surfing the crimson wave. Getting your period. The monthly strawberry week, the red menace, the English have landed from the French, who else? Having the painters in, the blob, run, don't walk, falling off the roof, a visit from Aunt Flo, and my favourite, the communists are in the summer house. A recent survey found over 5,000 slang terms for menstruation. And it's hardly surprising when billions of people around the world do it so that every single human being in history could be born. That's a condensation of a massive philosophical and existential and scientific reality. If nobody menstruated, nobody would be here. Sometimes I tell people this and they say, well, when you put it like that, and I have to insist that I'm not putting it like anything, that's the inescapable truth. So I'm working on this project for the Victorian Women's Trust, and our goal is to totally change the conversation around menstruation in Australian public life. I know, very ambitious. But it's urgent and important work, and I see it as care work. The Victorian Women's Trust facilitated a massive research project collating the responses of nearly 4,000 women here in Australia and around the world on their experience of menarche, menstruation and menopause. And this produced quantitative and qualitative data suggesting some very strong trends, and some of them I'll discuss today. But the reason why I'm telling you about that broader project is because in seeking to create a positive narrative around menstruation and menopause, we're really up against the menstrual taboo. And that is ancient and entrenched, and it finds expression in so many overt and subtle ways. As we've moved through this research phase and the analysis and now to writing the final document, the menstrual taboo is like our giant enemy, our big bad. It's the enemy of self-knowledge. It's the enemy of better education around menstruation and menopause, but also better education around sex, consent, self-esteem, and relationships. It's the enemy of open dialogue and the difficulties that women face with menstruation, but also the beautiful and positive experiences women have with menstruation and menopause are kept secret too, for fear of ridicule or revulsion. So, the menstrual taboo is the enemy of women telling the truth to each other and starting to organise for better conditions to remove things like economic penalties that they face for menstruating. And it's the enemy of connecting what's going on in your body with what's going on in the whole world. So linking the feminine experience with the environment and other progressive causes. So you can see I have strong opinions about the menstrual taboo being used to oppress and control women. But I think it actually negatively affects everyone to live in a society where menstruation is connected with shame. As I mentioned, it's our enemy, and we'll talk about it today, because one shocking thing that comes through in the research is that general knowledge about menstruation, even among women, is quite poor. So what do we know about it? I thought we could do a bit of a mental checklist. It's not going to be graded, or you won't get... I'm not going to publicly shame you if you don't know this. So just a couple of quick notes first. I'll be using explicit language as we go on, just correct terminology, no swear words. But fair warning, and this may be triggering for people who experience body dysphoria or have trauma around bodies and genitalia and reproductive organs. That said, I acknowledge that not all women menstruate, and not there are menstruators who aren't women. But our research and my talk today is about menstruation and women and the women who do menstruate. So if you'll forgive the occasional conflation of the two while we talk about biological functions of bodies. Also, if some of this isn't known to you, please don't consider it a personal failing. I think that the menstrual taboo, that big baddie that I just talked about, is to blame. And I wanted to tell you that through the course of working on this project, I have been on a very steep learning curve myself, someone who's been menstruating since my teenage years. I've just had a baby, and just learning about the connection between menstruation and fertility and conception and menopause has been largely obscured to me. And so I have found it incredibly confronting how much I don't know. So here we go. While I'm telling you this, maybe if you can just think about what would happen if more people did know this. So firstly, it's mostly women who do it. For on average, 5 days a month for roughly 40 years, which amounts to 6 to 7 years of your life, you spend menstruating. Or over 500 separate times. It's usually between 2 and 7 tablespoons, although every menstruating woman I've ever spoken to swears that it's more. Menstruation includes menarche, which is the technical name for your first period, regular periods throughout your cycling life, and then menopause, when the bleeding at semi-regular intervals stops, but the hormonal fluctuations do not. So briefly, menarche typically occurs between the ages of 10 and 15, so that's a fairly big window. Normal menstruation will be about 12 times a year from this adolescent starting point to the ages of 45 to 55. Next, we note, it's kind of violent. So as a biological process, after ovulation, when the egg travels down the fallopian tubes to the uterus, it arrives in this lush environment called the endometrium. And at that time, the endometrium is comprising thick blood vessel-rich glandular tissue. If the egg isn't fertilized, the process of shedding involves the breaking down of that lining, the tearing away of all those small connective blood vessels, and the loss of the tissue and the blood that constituted it happens through the vagina. The entire process occurs over a period of several days, and it is sometimes accompanied by uterine contractions. I'm laughing because I wonder if any of you have ever experienced these uterine contractions that help expel the menstrual endometrium. So cramps, it really hurts. Next thing to note, that menses, or the what is expelled from the body, is not actually blood. It's menstrual fluid contains some blood, but it's also cervical mucus, vaginal secretions, and endometrial tissue. And even as I'm saying that, I can kind of feel as though maybe some of you are going like, okay, it's cool, just sit with that, just let it, it's cool, it's fine, we're going to go on a journey together. Menstrual fluid is reddish brown, and it's a slightly darker colour than venous blood or the blood that's in your veins, because it comprises other things and it's made for a different purpose. It was recently discovered to contain stem cells. So does everyone kind of get that stem cells are used to make other cells, so you can build other cells for lungs and hearts and livers and pancreas and all sorts of things through stem cells? So stem cells at the moment are harvested from umbilical cords, and there's obviously, you might have heard, you know, there's obviously long-running battles to harvest stem cells from unused embryos. It's in your menstrual fluid that you wrap up in lots of layers and you put in the toxic waste disposal bin, and it goes into landfill. Here's another thing. If you take hormonal contraceptives, and by that I include the pill, implants, some IUDs, injections, then you don't ovulate. So you don't menstruate. So I was on the pill from 14 to 35, over 20 years, and I had a bleed every month, which I thought was a period. It wasn't. If you have a bleed every month, it's not a period. It's not menstruation. It's a withdrawal bleed caused by the break in the hormones your body is receiving. Now, that may or may not be okay, but it would be good if people understood exactly what that process was before they kept filling those scripts. And maybe doctors, I don't know about you, but I've never had a doctor ever explain the pill to me in all the 21 years that I was taking it. The average woman in Australia who uses tampons, pads, and panty liners to manage her period, as well as sundry items like new underwear, laundry soakers, painkillers, heat packs, will spend roughly $67 a month managing her period. Does that sound like a reasonable amount? That's not too much. Over a year, that's $800. Over the course of your menstruating life, it's upwards of $30,000, which, you know, rather than telling people to stop eating avocado toast so that they could put a deposit on a house, maybe we should stop charging women to menstruate. The same woman who uses these disposable single-use menstrual products will produce between 150 and 200 kilos of disposable waste in her life. Unknowingly, not because she's a bad person, but just because she's told that that's the only way to manage her period. So despite all of this, menstruation is mostly invisible. It's incredibly misunderstood and little discussed in places where the opposite should be true, like families, educational environments, workplaces, the medical community. And the consequences of that range from stigma and internalized shame, which is bad enough, but also alienation from self and partners, social networks, through to things like unplanned pregnancy and termination, difficulty conceiving, traumatic births. I think there's a very clear line connecting these with the menstrual taboo and alienating women from what's going on in their own bodies. So now we've established that. Were some of those facts shocking? Not really. Some of you are like, nah, I knew all that. Yeah. So for some of us, it's surprising to think how little information we are given. The cycling body is always somewhere in the ovulation cycle. So a good understanding of that process as it repeats over months and years would mean knowing your body better, predicting your moods and various needs, and having better control over things like your fertility and your contraception. It would also have knock-on effects for relationships, weight and body image, fitness, health. And at any given moment, I think that women are being affected by the menstrual taboo. So would you agree that in the average woman's life, this is a fairly significant experience? She'll almost certainly be impacted by it physically, emotionally, psychologically, socially, financially, professionally, culturally, and in terms of her religious practice, class, sexuality, and reproduction. If she doesn't menstruate, she might not be able to get pregnant, depending if she wants to do that or not. And if she experiences what's called menstrual dysfunction by the medical community, she'll face doctors who lack the appropriate research and development to diagnose and treat her. So isn't that something that we should talk about? So we'll turn now to the pervasiveness of the taboo. A taboo is something you're not supposed to talk about. It's a ban. It speaks to prohibition and censure and inhibition. There are punishments if you defy it. And there are social costs to breaking taboos. Taboos are often rooted in shame. We can trace the menstrual taboo back in time. These are ancient fears and hatreds at play here. You can find roots of the menstrual taboo in the key texts of all the major faiths. Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, all hold that menstrual blood and women who menstruate are unclean, impure, and should be segregated while they're menstruating. Pliny the Elder wrote an encyclopedia of natural history of ancient Rome. And I quote, "Contact with the monthly flux of women turns new wine sour, makes crops wither, kills grafts, dries seeds in gardens, causes the fruit of trees to fall off, dims," this encyclopedia, "dims the bright surface of mirrors, dulls the edge of steel, and the pretty badass, right? And the gleam of ivory kills bees, rusts iron and bronze, and causes a horrible smell to fill the air. Dogs who taste the blood become mad, and their bite becomes poisonous, as in rabies. Sounds hilarious now, and like a great movie, actually. But the menstrual taboo still finds different expressions even today across cultures and languages. So how did it start and where did it come from? This is going to be a very short history about the cultural logic of the menstrual taboo. Very briefly, pre-religious cultures grappled with female sexual and reproductive power in complex ways, from worshipping goddesses of harvest and the moon to adopting matrilineal authority in their societies. This changed dramatically with the advent of organized religion, where a huge cultural shift results in the policing and oppression of women's bodies, especially with regard to fertility and sex. Now, this is not to say that religion invented patriarchy, but there's a strong concomitant relationship. So if the core texts of major religions all characterize menstruation as unclean and contaminating and ungodly, this will obviously affect the cultures that practice these religions and grow up around them. But why did the original menses haters put this down in writing and insist that women accept segregation and punishment when they menstruate? So there's a huge field dedicated to unpacking this, but essentially it comes down to a fear of female sexuality and its corollary powers of persuasion, of control over men, and of reproduction. There's a fear of women because they can literally create life. One way to minimize and undermine that power is to categorize it as wrong and frightening, and this shores up male supremacy. Now, this is not to say that people who are affected by the menstrual taboo now have that as their goal. This is for us to go back in time and figure out where it comes from. So what are some examples of the menstrual taboo in action? Some of you might know of the mikveh, the ritual bath that Orthodox Jewish women take after they menstruate to make them clean again and mark the end of the time they may not be touched by their husbands. Or the menstrual huts in Nepal that exist to segregate women during their periods because it's believed that they will contaminate any food that they touch. The single biggest obstacle to education for many girls in African countries is that they stop going to school when they start menstruating, sometimes due to a lack of facilities and often because of stigma. A recent study published in 2017 in the UK found exactly the same thing. They looked at truancy patterns in areas of low socioeconomic background and found that many girls didn't attend school because their family couldn't afford menstrual products. That's Great Britain today. So cultures enforce overt punishment, and we are right to condemn that. But also when it is more invisible, it is no less powerful. So how does it operate here where it's largely subterranean? The menstrual taboo in Australia is less like one practice you can point to and more like a network of overlapping and intersecting discriminations and penalties. Women usually learn to hide the fact of their menstruation from partners, from bosses, friends, lovers, colleagues, and families. There are overarching material inequalities like a luxury tax on menstrual products and a lack of access to leave concessions in the workplace. There are real structural problems in educational institutions too, where girls are educated about menstrual management through corporations accessing school children directly with the approval of the Department of Education, signing them up for a life of purchasing expensive, environmentally disastrous disposable products that are single use. So did you know that most of the menstrual education that's delivered in schools is often delivered by representatives of companies that sell pads and tampons? I can't think of other subjects that would be where that kind of treatment would be allowed. So Janice Delaney said that one of the reasons that taboos die so hard in all types of civilizations is that they are rigorously taught to youngsters who dare not question them. To the uninitiated, they represent the status and privilege of adulthood. And when I read that, I kind of doubled back and just sort of was reeling, because I thought every kind of taboo that we teach young people, they believe is a mark of them becoming an adult. They believe that they've been let into this secret adult world where they have to keep these rules. And that's why it's very hard to unpack them and break them down. And through this research, I've talked to women of all ages who have found it difficult over decades of their life to confront the menstrual taboo in themselves. So research shows that most girls learn about menstruation from their mothers. And that means that sometimes they bring their own emotional baggage to menstrual education of their daughters. And the message that they get, that daughters get, is often on a variation on these themes. This comes through very strongly in the research. These are quotes. You're a woman now. This is the beginning of your adult life, which is a pretty full-on thing to tell a 10-year-old. Girls get the message that blood is dirty and embarrassing, that they're responsible for dealing with it every month, and don't tell anyone that you're menstruating, don't talk about it openly, don't let the blood leak onto your clothes, don't express your needs around this time, like for extra rest or different foods or easier routines. In popular culture, menstruation and the menstruating woman is either invisible or disgusting or the butt of a joke. I couldn't find a single period storyline on Neighbours. So I asked a friend, and seriously, because I love looking at popular culture and how it sometimes plugs the gaps of formal education for kids. But you watch Neighbours for 25 years and no one has ever had a period. I asked a friend who writes for Neighbours, and he said that it's tricky to get around the G rating. So I asked him to explain. He said the litmus test of the G rating is it in the writer's room. They have to say, would this storyline create an uncomfortable or awkward conversation for like a 7-year-old? And I thought, that's insane that the word menstruation, period, vagina, blood, tampon wouldn't pass that litmus test. There are a few period storylines on Home and Away because Home and Away is PG. But when I say a few, I mean, you know, over decades, a handful. So you can see the menstrual taboo operates on cultural, legal, and social levels as well as deeply personal. The research told us that women often experienced real alienation and shame around their periods, with attitudes often starting and being reinforced at home. In one heartbreaking response, a woman said that her girl self realised that when her dad joked about her mum having PMS or angry women who must be on that time of the month, that he now meant her as well. Brothers and even older sisters featured as antagonists to menstruating girls, with jokes about leakage, smells, weight gain and moodiness being made at home as well as at school. Mothers encouraging their daughters to get on with it and soldier on, and fathers showing obvious embarrassment and discomfort at discussions of menstruation came up repeatedly in the study, women of all ages. Girls and women told us over and again that school was also a scary place to be menstruating, and that something like a leak or blood on your clothes, or even other students seeing tampons and pads unused, would result in ruthless teasing or shaming, or its other name, bullying and harassment. And that sends the message to young girls that you are just as disgusting and you could be next, because it could happen to you at any time. Women talked about negotiating sexual interactions around their periods and hiding menstruation from partners, even long-term partners, because they found it shameful. Men have also grown up under the taboo, and some of them often show their revulsion at the reality of a bleeding vagina. And some, we had a lot of women say that their partners refuse sexual intimacy during menstruation. Women can find workplaces often hostile to navigating the reality of their menstrual life. Using sick leave when you're not sick was the most common complaint. Having to euphemize menstrual issues as like dentist appointments and other ailments also came up a lot. Jokes about PMS and menopause contribute to an uncomfortable and unsympathetic work environment, and women feeling penalized if they did take time off came through strongly as well. This is before we even get to workplaces in male-dominated industries where women sometimes can't even get access to facilities to manage their menstruation. The data also suggests that many women have difficult and traumatic experiences in the medical system around menstrual dysfunction. Some take years, even decades, to be diagnosed and treated for polycystic ovarian syndrome, endometriosis, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which has recently been added to the DSM for mental health in 2013, dysmenorrhea, among others. So let's just break this down and look at some of the messages that women and girls receive around menstruation from their families. Ask mum, and if she's got hang-ups, you just take those on too. From their partners, don't bleed on me, don't complain to me, and don't expect me to have sex with you a quarter of the time. From their bosses, I don't care if you're in pain and struggling, come to work, don't complain, or don't come in, but you'll have to use your sick leave and possibly lie about why. From doctors, I don't believe you. I don't believe you, that you're in this much pain. And if you do, it's normal. If you lost weight or had a baby, it would probably fix it. This happened more than once in the data. Women in different countries saying that doctors told them to lose weight to fix endometriosis, or being told that when they had a baby, it would sort them out. Definitely. Bring a human life into the world to fix that. From their friends, the message is, you know, I got you, girl, but this is a conspiracy between us. You know, here's a rescue tampon or pad or jacket to tie around your waist, and we'll deal with this without anyone noticing, and then we'll kind of be unconsciously reinforcing the menstrual taboo and the ties that bind between shame and guilt and anxiety. And from the culture that they live in, no, I don't want to know about it, I don't want to hear about it, and I don't even see it. So as you can imagine, this has a number of harmful impacts on girls and women, arguably on boys and men too. From hurting their sense of self-respect, to body image, openness and honesty with loved ones, to negatively affecting their sexual development. It can affect their grasp of consent, pleasure and desire. If girls get the message that a natural process of their body is shameful and wrong and disgusting, this is going to affect their relationship with their own body, but with other people's bodies, and what they are going to say yes to and what they are going to say no to and how grateful they are going to be for sexual attention. So I know this sounds dramatic, but it really is. This is a natural function of the body that's been stigmatized and invisibilized and penalized. Women who menstruate experience shame and guilt that is totally unnecessary and wrong. But it's powered by a menstrual taboo that not only alienates them from their bodies, but from each other. So it prevents open conversation and the kind of effective organizing required to dismantle it. Underpinning the menstrual taboo is a raft of unconscious, unexamined biases, both against menstruation as a legitimate process, but also with regard to women and their proscribed roles in society. Acknowledging that it exists, seeing the marks of it in yourself and your own attitudes, and I definitely have, asking what you might be able to do to disrupt it are the first steps to its undoing. The roots of the menstrual taboo are deep, but it's my hope that by starting honest conversations, presenting the evidence, and connecting women, we can take some meaningful steps towards undoing this damage. Because besides being normal and natural and absolutely essential, it's also incredibly empowering for women to know more about their bodies. we don't just want to remove that shame and stigma and judgment of the menstrual taboo, because that would take us from bad to neutral. We actually need to go further, and we need to help women not only understand and stop fearing their menstruation, but also possibly have a positive relationship with it. Even, dare I say, celebrate it. Because right now, this kind of positive attitude towards menstruation is seen as very fringe. It's seen as a kind of on the fringes of radical feminism and, you know, new age, hippie, spiritual, Wiccan, pagan, kind of earth mother stuff. And it's really so fundamental and so basic to the experiences of women that it shouldn't, you know, capitalism and patriarchy often work in tandem to really marginalise and produce certain attitudes about things. So what better way to completely sideline something uncomfortable or that disrupts the status quo than to ridicule it? And so why should women's entitlement to a narrative around menstrual well-being be treated this way, as kooky or crazy or extreme? So what would help? What might we demand if we all knew more and cared more and became filled with the righteous indignation that I am? As with most social ills, the answer is education. And that sometimes feels like a bit of a drag because you're like, that takes too long. But it will be intergenerational education that will change this. Better education of girls and women around their bodies, delivered by people who have worked on their shame and guilt and anxiety. Better education of educators, so that teachers, nurses, parents and counsellors can teach menstrual literacy after examining their own prejudices, and that they can commit to wanting better for girls, rather than representatives of corporations selling menstrual products. On the products that are used to manage menstruation, education that a lifetime reliance on expensive, disposable, single-use products is not the only option. But remove the luxury tax on those items anyway, so that women who, P.S., are also paid less and pay for contraception also don't pay extra tax because they're menstruating. Connect menstrual education with environmental awareness, women's rights, human rights. There are bigger discourses that can accommodate a conversation about menstrual well-being, and broader discussions of equality and equity. Institute menstrual policies in workplaces and collective bargaining agreements so that women aren't penalised professionally in industrial contexts where they already face disadvantage. So the vision is for a community where better menstrual literacy might start with girls and women, but it will go beyond that to include everyone, where we challenge and refuse to accept shame for what our bodies do and what they're capable of, and where we can effectively organise for rights and entitlements around menstruation in schools and workplaces, as well as stop the financial penalties for menstruating. I want women to see the connection between menstruation and contraception, conception, birth, and menopause, and feel like that they have the knowledge and tools to feel in control and supported through those experiences, and for women to help each other with the tough stuff that comes with being a menstruator. The menstrual cycle is an incredible process, and what's more, it's an optimal tool for mindfulness, for self-awareness and self-respect among women and towards women. So it actually has great utility and function for more than just itself. Menstrual literacy has the potential to be a vehicle for building not only self-respect but mutual respect for people's varying needs and capacities at different times, and for the integrity of bodies. So to become menstrually aware and to promote menstrual well-being in yourself and loved ones is also a radically political act. And so just by being here today, you've begun that. So thank you. Thank you. Good questions? Yeah. Do I stay here? Yeah. Hi.
We have just a couple of minutes for questions, so just one or two questions from the audience. Please raise your hand if there's one just here.
Hello. I nearly didn't come here today, but I'm so pleased I did.
So am I.
I thought I was past all that.
You have much to teach us.
You started out by saying that without menstruation, none of us would be here. And in trying to present a very positive attitude towards menstruation, how do we convince young women who have no intention of procreating that it is a positive thing? Because actually, it's a bugger of a nuisance.
Well, I reckon that that there are ways of I think that education, better education of young women, might make it less of a bugger and a nuisance. And also giving women more options to manage their periods besides here's a pad, here's a tampon, here's the pill when you're 15. You know, besides those usual channels that have gone down. I think that some of that negative attitude towards menstruation is constructed and can be deconstructed. But for people who have painful periods, who have only negative associations with it, and certainly women who have no intention of having children or who feel as though, or who even want to reject the kind of biological essentialism that, you know, that menstruation is about, is what being a woman is about, I have absolute sympathy for. And I think that the same goes for them, in that knowing your body better, knowing how your body connects to its environment, understanding that the processes that happen inside you can be listened to and managed and helped, I think would make a woman who didn't have children live a happier life. So I guess it's about leveraging that broader... I don't think it's good to say to women, menstruation is good because it's what's going to help you have babies, even if they are going to have babies, because I actually think it's so much more valuable and all-encompassing than that. But connecting it to better social outcomes, connecting it to having more money, connecting it to having more respect in your life, not having to deal with pain in secret, I think appealing to women's sense that of the injustice of how things are at the moment is usually a good motivator. Get them angry. You get people angry, you get them moving, you know.
One more question? Yeah, okay.
Hi, sorry, I can't see you. I'm just kind of really interested in the way the media talks about menstruation versus very bloody violence. And so Rupi Kaur, who's here at the festival, she posted a picture on Instagram of her underwear stained with a little bit of, tiny bit of blood because of her period.
It's a beautiful picture.
Got removed a couple of times. And yet on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, we're bombarded with images from war of people being blown up. And, you know, and obviously the censors that run these kinds of sites have no issue with that, but have an issue with women's bodily functions. And how do we fight that in the media when everything that we're, you know, doing even on social media is working against us?
Well, one good thing to do would be, in order to check out that picture that Lauren describes and also see a lot more amazing menstrual activism, is to Google menstrual activism. And you will see artists, writers, poets, general, you know, rabble-rousers coming up with incredibly visual and inventive ways to protest against the menstrual taboo. And some of them are just insanely beautiful. And I think that part of it is a desensitization. Part of it is that we as a society are desensitized to seeing blood in the context of violence. So when you consider that menstrual blood is the only blood that is produced non-violently, that's kind of a mind-blowing thing. And yet it's, you know, we are in this cubicle by ourselves and we're like, oh, yuck, I hate this, and we put it away and we put it in the radioactive waste bin. And there's a kind of, you know, which I think all of that sends really strong messages to us. And I think to be able to desensitize ourselves in the positive way, the more menstrual imagery we see that we link with positive engagement, the more we will want to see. And so I think it is partly about connecting with other people who are already on this journey and finding your people, finding other women, finding other menstruators, finding other people who love talking about their periods. I love talking about periods. And I'm in two Facebook groups, which are basically like Rags Club. And we go on and we're like, oh, this happened. This happened to me. This, like, describing everything from, like, you know, timing to consistency to, like, regularity to whatever. Or, you know, I just watched a movie and it had a really cool sex scene that had period blood in it or whatever. Just sharing, like, period stuff is a little, you know, yeah, we do it in secret Facebook groups. But it's a start, you know. It's a beginning of connecting with other women. In the 70s, you know, women were meeting in each other's lounge rooms, having consciousness-raising groups, you know, and sort of saying to each other for the first time, like, I have a period, or I hate my husband, or whatever. And so it's being able to tap into that history, I think, of women talking to other women candidly, openly. Hearing someone else say it means that you feel less ashamed of it. So shame is really infectious. That's how taboos are so effective, is that when mum's thinking, oh my God, you getting your period is like triggering me back to when I got my period and my mum told me I couldn't use tampons because we're Catholic. You know, like, I'm relating stuff from the data, but she's thinking that, but she's also saying to her daughter, she's like, everything's fine, babe, everything's fine. And her daughter's freaking out and she's freaking out. The kids pick up on this, you know? And so it's breaking those cycles. The good thing is that positive regard is also infectious. So if you start to see that Rupi Kaur picture, I have it up on the wall of my office. It's beautiful. It's a picture of a woman's blood leaking from her pants onto her bed. My kids, all boys, aged 9, 7, and 1, wander in and out and they see it, and it's normal to, they know that I write about periods. And so I think normalizing it and celebrating it, as trite as that might sound, is the way forward. Yeah.
So Karen Pickering's book of women's writing on positive women's writing.
That book's about sex.
On sex.
The next book's available, about blood.
Is available.
What next?
For sale over here. And yeah. You'll be available to sign books.
Certainly.
In the loft.